afternoon. It's Wednesday, the 28th of June, 2017, just after 1 o'clock. Welcome to UK Column News. I'm your host, Mike Robinson, and with me in the studio, Patrick Henningsen. Thanks again, Pat, for joining us.
Great to be with you, Mike.
And we're going to get straight into, Prince William, David Cameron, Theresa May, FIFA. What's going on here?
Well, this story just broke last night. Mike, this is an extraordinary story. This is really sort of bringing up some skeletons from the closet. Go back to 2010 when Britain sent its A-team, basically. Its A-team. I'll go back to that slide.
Okay.
That's Prime Minister, newly anointed Prime Minister David Cameron, the future king, Prince William, Duke of Cambridge. Is that his title?
Could be.
And David Beckham, Sir David Beckham. A knight of the realm, no less. So all three of those were sent to Zurich to secure England's bid for the 2018 World Cup. And unfortunately, they came back empty-handed. It was a huge humiliation, Mike. So the fallout from that is there was a few things that happened after that. Anyway, this FIFA report has just been come out. They've been sitting on it for a while, and they've just released it. So David Cameron and Prince William, present at meetings, were vote trading, was discussed, quid pro quos, to basically get countries on side to vote for England in exchange for a number of enticements.
Bribes, did you say?
Well, it's not clear what exactly the bribes were, but we do know that there were promises made in kind for a friendly match with Thailand, who's, I think, ranked 120th right now in the world. Mm-hmm. And so a friendly with Thailand, that was canceled as soon as England didn't get the bid, by the way. Mm-hmm. And then maybe jobs for Jack Warner, vice president of FIFA, for his adopted son at either Tottenham Hotspur or Aston Villa Football Club. Those promises were also made, not directly by Cameron and Prince William, but by members of the English
delegation.
And also, this was an amazing one, promises by England to vote for South Korea in their bid for the 2022 World Cup, which Qatar secured eventually, if South Korea would vote for England for the 2018 bid. So this is a huge FIFA corruption scandal. This is coming from, you know, the UK has been aggressive in pursuing Russia for all sorts of corruption regarding sports, blood doping, getting their Olympic team struck off. Very instrumental in all that, along with the United States. So here, and now we have, this is the British A team caught in the center of a FIFA corruption scandal.
Okay.
Unbelievable.
Now, you were covering this on 21st Century War, right along the story. So
back in 2010.
So here you've got a headline here saying, Queen's MI5 detains Russian honey trap spy in response to England's 2018 World Cup humiliation.
Well, this was a story that we sort of took a chance on. This was back in the early days of 21st Century War, and we just really got started a year in. And we saw that the timing of this, this was Mike Hancock's MP from Southampton, Liberal Democrat MP. His personal assistant was Russian, Miss Katya in the media. Her real name, her full name, is Ekaterina Zatulivater, and she was detained by MI5 immediately after England lost the bid. And so we thought that the timing of this could be a diplomatic tit-for-tat between Britain and Russia. They accuse her of being a spy. Mike Hancock sat on the select committee, I think, for defense. So there was this idea that she had infiltrated
Perfumo affair type.
Exactly the Perfumo affair. And so here's a picture of her here. We'll go back.
Yeah.
So and her father accused Theresa May, who was Home Secretary at the time, who was really under Theresa May. She was detained. It was under her authority, really. He said, for dragging my daughter through the dirt. He accused the Home Secretary of the British government, I believe, of that. And so this was then confirmed. So we took a chance on that story at the time, and yes, it was confirmed by Russian Charged Affairs in London that, yes, this was a diplomatic tit-for-tat, and this she wasn't a spy. But she'd been vetted for, I think, as far back as, I don't know how long the process took, but almost a year, I'm not sure, to be an MP. She apparently is very qualified for the job and resident in the UK and so forth. So that's interesting. How far this story goes back. This was the intrigue at the time, Mike.
Yeah.
So this was the first major diplomatic row between the UK and Russia in this kind of current series that we have.
Yeah.
So it really started with the World Cup bid, and things progressed from Sochi then to the Ukraine and so forth. So this is interesting. So,
and then you follow that up with a tit-for-tat diplomatic row pits Putin against the Queen.
Yeah, and so this was all part of the same thing, same story. Now, what was interesting was England didn't get the bid. Okay, and what one of the reasons for this was the Sunday Times and Panorama, BBC's Panorama, was very aggressive in their sort of FIFA corruption coverage right before this bid process or the decision-making was taking place in Switzerland. And so I don't think the members of FIFA looked too favorably on Britain, who is currently trashing FIFA across, you know, at least the Sunday Times and the BBC, but all the media was covering it at the time. There was a huge amount of that. So that didn't fall too well. And so Jack Warner, vice president of FIFA, looked our future king, I guess Prince William, if you want to call him that, straight in the eye and said, you've got my vote. And then they went back. They flew back on a private jet, I think, Beckham, Cameron, and Prince William, only to find out that they
had lost.
They lost to Russia. And so since then, everyone's been trying to basically take this World Cup away from Russia. There's a whole bunch of stories. We've just got a few here. Petition to ban the country from hosting the World Cup. This was on the Huffington Post. There's all sorts of scandals that were being pushed around and insinuations that Russia was somehow cheating. This was a kind of interesting tabloid story here. Again, this is targeting a British audience who really would die to have England host the World Cup in 2018. Three lines on the shirt. Oh, you must be kidding. Putin's alleged granddaughter warns Russia could lose their bid over security concerns following the St. Peter's bombing. Now, this is interesting because a lot of people were accusing Putin of staging his own false flag in St. Petersburg. But if you think about it, look at the timing of that story there, which was circulated in The Sun. So saying that, oh, Russia shouldn't be allowed to host a World Cup because of security concerns. So this is, you can look at the story that way, too. So Human Rights Watch as well got in on the act here, calling for apparently the construction workers needed some Human Rights Watch protection.
Because really Russia isn't really capable of hosting a World Cup because they're not looking after the construction workers properly.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is from Human Rights Watch, obviously big champions of people like the White Helmets. So maybe they should send the White Helmets in to work on the stadiums, maybe. I don't know. So, but that's sort of part of the circus. And again, we have another one. Calls for Russia to be stripped after latest doping claims. So this doping scandal we saw over the Olympics over the summer again. So there's a full program here, Mike, basically to steal this event. Very prestigious international sporting event, the most prestigious international sporting event in the world. A big PR opportunity for any country that has the opportunity to host the World Cup.
Yeah.
I think in PR terms, it's even better than the Olympics, Mike, because it lasts for a month. And you've got everybody from around the world congregating and having great fun in your country. And I'm sure Russia can throw a good party. And so, yes, there will be security concerns, absolutely. And I think we've got another story.
Yeah, so British MP, FIFA should ban Russia from hosting World Cup. And then finally, this one, World Cup corruption report, England-friendly plan, a form of bribery. But I think what you wanted to highlight here was the image.
Well, this is a classic BBC. This is what the BBC does to us on a daily basis. So this is about British corruption, okay? But yet, look at the image the BBC chose, which is Qatar. So immediately the reader, who doesn't like to read, most people only read headlines. We know this from scientific studies now. World Cup corruption, Qatar. You see how the link's made. But it has nothing to do with the 2020 thing. This story is about 2018. It is about England, David Cameron, Prince William, caught present at meetings with discussing vote swapping. Who knows what else, Mike?
Yeah.
So this is a huge scandal from a country that is trying to actively take the World Cup away from Russia.
And a country which has been systematically accusing FIFA of corruption and Russia of corruption over the doping scandal and so on. Britain, once again, demonstrating as a level of hypocrisy, which is pretty difficult to quantify.
I think it was Loretta Lynch, Department of Justice Attorney General, said that FIFA is an organization influenced by organized crime and corruption. Few people who know about big sports like football are not going to argue with that. There is a lot of proximity of organized criminals and in big sports, especially football.
The same could be said for the Olympics.
The same, absolutely. From the Olympic bidding process is no less as corrupt. Oh, the money doesn't have to be in brown envelopes, Mike. Mm. There's lots of ways to make payments to influence people's decisions on this voting process.
Mm. Okay, well, let's move on to Petya then, the cyber attack which is going on at the moment. And the Register here have a great article called Everything You Need to Know About the Petya or Not Petya Nasty, which is trashing PCs worldwide. And they're saying it's now increasingly clear that the global outbreak of a file scrambling software nasty targeting Microsoft Windows PCs is designed not to line the pockets of criminals, but to spread merry mayhem. The malware, dubbed Not Petya because it masquerades as the Petya ransomware, exploded across the world on Tuesday, taking out businesses from shipping ports and supermarkets to ad agencies and law firms. Once inside the corporate network, this well-oiled destructive program worms its way from computer to computer, encrypting the infected machine's file systems. Although it demands about $300 in Bitcoin to unscramble the hosted data, the mechanisms put in place to collect the money from victims quickly disintegrated. Despite the slick programming behind the fast-spreading malware, little effort or thought was put into pocketing the loot, it appears. And so what the Register is saying here is that this was nothing to do with trying to earn bucks or Bitcoin from this. This is purely being put out there to cause trouble. And so it occurred to me who might be responsible for this. And Patrick, the first thing we can say is that Edward Snowden has chimed in, I believe.
Well, before I even showed you the Snowden article, immediately you said this had to have been, it's got the fingerprints of the intelligence agencies on it. And then lo and behold, this story pops up. So Edward Snowden says this is definitely an NSA operation, basically. But one thing is interesting. One of the targets of this, Mike, would be Bitcoin, because it was the criminalization of Bitcoin. Even though the Register rightly says it's not about collecting the ransom loot, it's more about, by guilt by association, Bitcoin is then tarred with the brush of this virus. So again, maybe calls from politicians saying, we need to regulate Bitcoin, we need to maybe have some sort of identification protocols, or maybe Bitcoin needs to be pushed off and we'll present you with a new cryptocurrency that's biometrically tied to you.
Could be. In the meantime, of course, it's difficult for them to accuse the Russians here because it's mainly Russia and Ukraine that are the targets of this. Yeah. Some Western companies getting hit. But let's put this into a bit of a broader context. If we go back a year or 18 months, Jens Stoltenberg from NATO, who is the NATO Secretary General, has been in speech after speech over the last 12 to 18 months, really highlighting the fact that as far as NATO is concerned, cybersecurity is almost its entire reason to exist at the moment. So I have to say it is pretty lucky that these massive attacks are taking place these days, particularly high publicity attacks, because it gives NATO the opportunity to continue to exist and gives it some credibility. So that's a bit of a coincidence.
It expands their remit too. And so NATO now wanting to be active, what, in the cybersphere?
Yeah. So well, that's exactly right.
It's increasing their remit.
Absolutely,
so
absolutely.
When the remit should be shrinking, it's expanding.
That's absolutely right. So, and again, by coincidence, just pure coincidence, Chatham House running its Cyber 2017 conference in London.
This week?
The last 2 days.
Oh, so fancy.
What day is this? Monday and Tuesday it was. Okay. So that's just another coincidence. And who was there? Well, Michael Fallon there, the Secretary of State for War, he was there and speaking. And it didn't take him long to get onto Russia in his speech.
He's a noted cyber expert, isn't he?
Absolutely. So it didn't take him long to get onto Russia, he said. And of course, there have been attacks on America, with the United States Office of the Director of National Intelligence concluding that Russia had targeted the presidential election. So there you go. That's definitive. It's true. It's a fact because Michael Fallon has said it. Okay. And he went on to say this, Patrick. Reuters has reported that Russia used malware implants on Android devices to track and target Ukrainian artillery. So he has specified this as a fact. Patrick, is that a fact?
Yeah, well, on the first point, Mike, on the previous slide, you said that Fallon said the Office of the Director of National Intelligence in the United States said that Russia had hacked. They did not. So Michael Fallon is lying to you there, I think it's fair to say. The Office of the Director of National Intelligence said with high confidence they believed it was possible that the Russians somehow hacked something to do with the U.S. elections, although they were not specific, presented zero evidence to date, okay? And 17 agencies signed that, including the Coast Guard. I'm sure they have a lot to do with cyber intelligence. Yeah. And the other one was, I think, the one who does the satellites, the GEOs at that agency or something or rather.
Okay.
The weather satellites.
Yeah.
They signed it too. So
is that NOAA?
Might have been NOAA. So in other words, that was a completely inconclusive, bogus statement released by the Office of the Director of National Intelligence, totally politicized at the time in the run-up to the heat of the election between Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton, a completely politicized event and with nothing in it. So no beef in the burger. And then in terms of the other story that Reuters reported, so he's saying Reuters reported as if Reuters is some sort of authority, Mike. And they reported, along with other mainstream media at the time, that Russia used malware implants on Android devices to hack, track, and target Ukrainian artillery. Only problem, Mike, is this is fake news. Because even this was admitted in March, Voice of America, of all people, this is a partly U.S. government-funded media outlet, was forced to run with this story. My guess, Mike, they ran with this because it was about to go nuclear in the mainstream press. So the cyber firm at the center of the Russian hacking claims supposedly misread their data.
Just a faux pas.
And so they're called CrowdStrike. So they were hired by the FBI to investigate the DNC leaks. But no one investigated the servers themselves, did any sort of forensic analysis, and they made up the data, presented made-up data, that Russia hacked Ukrainian artillery. This story was broken in March. So what's Michael Fallon talking about, Mike? Is this man have a problem with facts or news? Who's writing his speeches for him? So he's basically reading out fake news and putting it across to the public as if it were, if it's something that actually happened when it had been debunked a long time ago.
Well, I'm afraid we're just going to put a dunce hat on him because he is a dunce. There you go. Michael Fallon, what more can we say?
And this is on top of what we statements about chemical weapons yesterday.
Absolutely. But there's more. Because he went on. He said, but there's a third way in which we can protect our national infrastructure, and that's by strengthening our deterrence.
Strengthening our deterrence.
So you're looking forward to this. It's coming. Here we go. So we are using our rising budget to invest in full spectrum capability from the carriers to Ajax armored vehicles, fifth generation F-35, doesn't fly, but that doesn't matter apparently, to the latest UAVs, signaling to potential cyber strikers that the price of an online attack would invite a response from any domain, air, land, sea, or cyberspace.
Wait a minute, hold on. Is he insinuating that it will respond to a hacker by sending in an F-35 jet?
Yes.
What I'm reading?
Yes, and the hacker would laugh at him because they would simply hack the F-35 jet.
Or the aircraft carrier,
because as we pointed out yesterday, the new British aircraft carrier is running computer systems with Windows XP on them, unsupported.
I think, when was the last security update for Windows XP, Mike? Was it
about 2 years
2002?
Ago.
2002? Oh, no.
They kept extending the support, but nonetheless, Britain's aircraft carrier is likely to be vulnerable.
Yeah,
as is the F-35.
That's an extraordinary statement, Mike. So Michael Fallon's basically threatening to deploy military hardware against a perceived cyber threat.
He is.
So what level of insanity are we at right now? Are they totally detached from reality? Or what sort of universe are we living now?
These are very good questions, Patrick. Very good questions.
Who is this man? Who's writing his speeches?
Indeed.
Some 24-year-old Oxford master's in political science, maybe, or someone reading history at whatever college.
Yeah.
At Oxford.
Who knows?
I don't know.
But let's move on to Trump.
Okay, so this is a follow-up from what we talked about yesterday. So sketchy firm behind Trump dossier is stalling investigators. What's this all about? Do you remember right before the inauguration in January, a dossier was produced about Donald Trump's indiscretions in Moscow, involving all sorts of things, including using terms such as golden shower and so forth. This was a saucy dossier, which was presented at a intelligence briefing, a top secret briefing to President Obama at the time, who was a lame duck president. Turns out that this dossier was fake. It was produced by a man named Christopher Steele, retired British intelligence.
MI6.
MI6, yeah. Supposedly, yeah. Anyway, something or other. And so he produced this fake report and then basically injected it into the Washington circles, and it got circulated around through the FBI. Trump got briefed on it, went crazy. CNN totally ran with the story, by the way, at the time. That's when Trump called him out as fake news. So the firm who commissioned this, they're called Fusion GPS. So they have been subpoenaed by a Senate Judiciary Committee, and they're refusing to respond. So basically,
they have the right to refuse to respond.
They do. They're kind of pleading the fifth, as it were. So
wow.
This is amazing. The company that commissioned this, who paid Jonathan Steele, I don't know what Steele was paid, maybe 50 grand or something like that. The total bill for this whole operation was probably somewhere around $2.5 million, and it looks like the founders of this company, this got links to Mexico City, financial magazine in Mexico City, and so this sounds like a CIA front company to me. It seems like it anyway. Maybe it's not, but this was under the heading of opposition research at the time. This was used to discredit Donald Trump. And again, we're not taking sides here of any political party. We're just stating fact. This is what happened. So it's really amazing. Story. So again, this firm, this whole Russia thing now is starting to crumble, Mike, and it's crumbling rapidly. This whole house of cards, to use a commonly used term, is just falling to pieces right now. Every single leg of Russiagate is now being exposed as fake, fraud, hoax. That's what it's been really from the whole U.S. election cycle till now. So it's amazing.
Okay, let's move on then, and we'll head back to Grenfell Tower just briefly. And this is Inside Housing magazine, and they're really saying that London Fire Brigade had... It's amazing how this information is just being drip-fed through the media. So Inside Housing has released this. It's been picked up by the BBC and other mainstream outlets, and it's just being... drip, 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 one step at a time, little bits of information. So what they're saying is the London Fire Brigade warned all London councils about the risks of external cladding on their buildings. And they did that in May of this year. And this was following tests of the panels that took place, following a fire in Shepherd's Bush last August. And the fire brigade had urged councils to review the cladding that they were putting on buildings, take appropriate action to mitigate the fire risk. So this was relating to Shepherd's Court, and it included a report which was commissioned by the fire brigade, and Inside Housing got a copy of that report. It was compiled by fire specialists Bureau Veritas. And they tested the panels beneath windows at Shepherd's Court, and they found that the panels withstood fire, but as it developed and the polystyrene within it took hold, then they were subject to much more serious fires. So this was known about in May, and we start to see more of the timeline coming together, but we still see the cover up of many of the facts, and we're still not talking about the true number of casualties yet.
And those numbers are going to be eventually revealed, maybe not by the mainstream press, Mike, maybe by the alternative media first.
That's quite likely, I think.
Yeah, I think it is definitely what's going to happen, because if the mainstream press, all of you people at the Guardian or the Times or the Sun or the Mirror, do they not have the resources, Mike, to put together a basic database of who has died and who has survived and then subtract that with the estimated total number of occupants in the building? Are they not able to do that? They seem to have legions of investigative journalists on their payrolls, and pretty much budgets to pursue good size investigations on any number of domestic stories. Why hasn't anybody done that yet? Why hasn't Channel 4 done that? Why hasn't the BBC done that? What about ITV? Do they not have any money to put a spreadsheet together? That's my question, Mike.
Well, I'm afraid I believe they do have the money to do that, so we must look in other directions to try to work out the answer to that question.
So we'll see. Maybe an alternative media outlet will beat the mainstream to give a definitive list of who has died, who survived, and who is unaccounted for.
Yeah.
So we'll see.
Okay, we'll move on to pensions. And this is the Office for National Statistics, who have issued at least part of their wealth and assets survey. The new one is out today. And they are saying that most people, most particularly young people who are using the new workplace pension scheme, they're automatically enrolled on pensions, are still not saving enough for a pension, and they're not going to have much fun. So this is a bit of a coincidence again, because there are actually two or three reports out on this issue today. One of the other ones was the Scottish Widows Retirement Report 2017, and they're saying that there's no doubt that auto-enrollment has been a success in kick-starting the savings habit for millions, but it's not a silver bullet. Auto-enrollment may be lulling people into a false sense of security that they're putting away enough for a comfortable retirement. For many, that's simply not the case, particularly given retirement is looking more expensive than ever. We also need to ensure that we don't see a rise in opt-in rates as minimum contributions levels increase from we need to ensure that we don't see a rise in opt-in rates as minimum contribution levels increase from April 2018. They're saying that 70% of people that are in work aged under 30 face an £8,000 pension shortfall because they're not saving enough. They're vastly underestimating this.
How about 80,000?
Well, let's have a look at some of this. So 70% of under 30s failing to save enough for retirement. They're saying that the auto enrollment automatically takes 1% of your salary, and then your employer has to match that. So you're going to be saving 2% of your salary is a default position. And what is that going to get you at the end of the day? Absolutely nothing. Now, what's interesting is that when we go back to the Office for National Statistics data, we get this graph, a bit small text, so it's difficult to see it on screen. But what we find here is that probably 80% of the respondents in the survey, when they were asked why are they not making sensible savings provision for their pensions, through one type of answer or another, basically 80% of them were saying, because we don't earn enough. We don't make enough money to make provision for our pensions. So then we've got the whole issue of state pensions. So that's private pensions, state pensions. And there's a report out today from the University of Kent basically saying that we've got to means test state pensions, and we've got to take state pensions away from people that are on the top level of tax. Mm-hmm. Right? Now, a lot of people may say that that sounds like a pretty reasonable thing to do. Why should people on large salaries be getting access to a state pension? But in fact, what is happening here is that we are removing the idea of universal benefits, universal state benefits. Now, again, some people might think that that's a good idea because of the massive disparity between the richest and the rest. But where does that end? If you look at the way government is treating people that are disabled at the moment on disability benefits, you look at the way that people are treating people, the government is treating people who are in social housing, like the people at Grenfell Tower, you find that it's not just an attack on the upper incomes. It's an attack at every income level within the country. Mm-hmm. So if we're prepared to say, well, because some people are really earning too much to benefit in this way from a universal benefit, therefore we'll scrap universal benefits, there are implications of that for everybody. And that's a Pandora's box that people may not want to open. right? But let's just remember once again what the reality of the situation is, because the question has to be asked, why can people not afford to make pension contributions? The reason is because of the level of debt, and therefore the fact that salaries are being squeezed beyond all recognition. And of course, we've got this fundamental issue of the types of jobs that are being produced in the West, in Britain and the United States, because government will talk about numbers of jobs, but they won't talk about the types of jobs. We're not producing high quality, high value, high salary jobs. We're producing low quality jobs, serving coffee, stacking shelves, these types of things. And that's why people can't afford to save for their pensions. This issue is ignored in all these reports, and it needs to be dealt with.
Yeah, the types of pensions, even if you have a job with Sainsbury's or any of these sort of big corporations that seem to be some of the biggest hirers right now in the country, the amount that's going to be left after working, let's say you're with them for 15 years, or whatever, it'll be enough to sustain you, Mike, for what, a couple of years in your retirement? Maybe one, maybe 2 years, in the real terms of the cost of living. So they're really selling a dream, Mike, that's not there. There's no way that it will measure up to the reality of the cost of living, especially if you go down the road 20 years or 25 years, as somebody who's in their sort of 40s might be looking at.
Okay, let's talk mental health, Patrick, because the government has announced that teachers will be given mental health training, which is going to make a real difference to children's lives. Apparently, they've pledged that every secondary school in the country will be offered mental health first aid training by 2020. And this is the organization, Mental Health First Aid, which is going to provide that training.
Mental health first aid. So they've bastardized the term first aid, which is for medical first aid, right?
Right.
And they've co-opted this for mental health.
That's right.
That's amazing.
So it's going to be delivered by this social enterprise organization, Mental Health First Aid England. It's part of a series of measures, they say, to address the hidden injustice of poor mental health across society. And they're going to start with secondary school age children. Research that's based on research from the National Association of Schoolmasters Union and Union of Women Teachers, which found that 98% of teachers had come into contact with pupils who were experiencing mental health issues, but only 46% of them reported receiving training on children's mental health. Well, Theresa May said that when she stood on the steps of Downing Street on her first day as Prime Minister, she said that the disparity in mental health services was one of the burning injustices our country faces. Tackling poor mental health is a huge challenge, she says, and we'll keep our promises and meet the challenge with the comprehensive cross-society response that's required. MHFA, the Mental Health First Aid Charity Director, Caroline Hansel, said mental health in young people is a growing health concern, with half of all lifetime cases of mental health issues starting at the age of 14. And Patrick, I've got to ask your view on this, because it seems to me that if child's mental health is a growing concern, is that just happening as a natural result of what the pressures of the modern world, or is it because they're being given mobile phones at the age of five, playing computer games, access to pornography, sex education from the age of five, sexual orientation education from the age of five, gender education from the age of five. Do you think mental health charities are perhaps feeding off this?
Yeah, so they're creating the conditions for children to have what they call mental health issues. I don't want to use the term mental health issue, because that in itself is a bit of a distortion. The problem is in the business of clinical psychology or clinical psychiatry, they're coming up with new terms every year to basically identify any specific behavior which they think is a mental health issue sort of indicator or behavior. So these terms are just piling up. I mean, when we were in primary school, there was no such thing as ADHD. Mm. Maybe 90% of the class had it. But so hence 90% of people that we went to school with weren't popping pills for the first 20 years of their young life. Unfortunately, that's not the case now, Mike. Mm. There's a lot of people that are being given prescription drugs based on terms that have been invented by a medical industry that seems to be self-perpetuating. So that's on that side. The other side is, yes, the children are being inundated with all sorts of things being thrown at them that, quite frankly, are probably not natural for a 5, 6, 7, 8-year-old, 9-year-old, 10-year-old, even right up to, you know, 14. You know, as a young adult, yeah, sure, they can grapple with some of the more difficult things.
No, but if a child is exhibiting, if a child is exhibiting mental health issues at 14, the problem didn't happen at 13, it happened at 5, 6, 7, 8.
Correct, correct. Not only that, but poor diets, you can add to that.
Vaccines.
Yeah, having your nose stuck in a smartphone for the first 10 years of your life, I mean, it's totally ridiculous. Mm. Why are parents allowing their kids just to have the right to have a smartphone? Mm. At what age? How young do they have smartphones now? You might know.
Well, I know that there are primary school children in Plymouth that are sleeping with their phones under their pillows, switched on.
How old? Youngest?
7, 8.
7, 8. Sleeping with smartphones under their pillows at 7 and 8.
Yeah.
Okay, that's got to do a number on your head. Yeah. Not only that, physiologically as well.
Yeah.
You got the radiation issue. So this, I think a lot of this is, Mike, you can lay some of the blame of this, most of it, at the feet of the parents, because it's still the choice of the parents whether they're going to go and buy a smartphone for their child as well. There's no law that says they have to, but yet this seems
for
to
sure.
be the norm.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Interesting.
Okay, well, we're coming towards the end here, but let's just say we did tell you so, what was going to happen, and it seems to be happening. The infighting is taking place. Here we've got Brexit. And I've just chosen the Sun for the sake of variety, but this was across most of the mainstream press. Cabinet split over Brexit as key figures disagree over how long a transitional trade deal will be in place. And so they're busy infighting. So how is any negotiation supposed to take place when these guys have not yet decided what it is they're going to negotiate?
I love the Sun has this new online headline style where they do this sort of alliteration thing at the beginning of each headline. But so this is, to me, Mike, this is Punch and Judy.
Absolutely.
To basically submerge Brexit in a mire of red tape, legalese, and political rhetoric back and forth to the point where nobody will ever understand exactly what's happening. And the public will just at some point throw their hands up and say, just are we in or are we out? Either one's fine. You know, we're done with this Brexit thing. So that's where it's heading, I think.
Yes.
So.
Okay, and to end then, Pat, you wanted to highlight this article in The Guardian.
Well, this was a very interesting, more on the scientific side, but, you know, we all do look up at the sky at night, bright night. Scientists explain rare phenomenon of the nocturnal sun. So they're really talking about how sometimes some evenings are brighter than others at different times of the year. And this has to do with the zonal effects and the molecular structure of atoms being affected by the sun's radiation, and hence changing the amount of electricity that's conducted through the anatomical structures there in the upper echelons of the atmosphere. It's a really fascinating story, Mike. What an amazing round globe we live on.
Yes, indeed. Okay, thank you very much, Patrick. We'll end it there, and we will be back at the same time tomorrow, 1 p.m. Thank you very much for joining us. Bye-bye.